Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian antidote to the case of the political Mondays, brought to you by the magazine for free minds and free markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangyu Ward. Happy mosquito season, friends.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
I am going to read a headline to make everyone's flags go half-mast. This one comes from Reason's very own Joe Lancaster from Friday.
Because we're all pirates?
Yes. Ron DeSantis bullies Bud Light like Elizabeth Warren bullies Amazon. The news peg here, in case you have better things to do with your life than keeping tabs on the latest culture warring. The Florida governor, amid a presidential campaign that seems stalled in a distant second place, sent a letter to the State Board of Administration of Florida, which oversees the Sunshine State's pension fund, requesting a formal review into the conduct of the beer-making giant Anheuser-Busch InBev, terrible name, over that company's backlash-inducing decision several months back to send some personalized cans of Bud Light to the transgender TikTok influencer Dylan Mulvaney. It is already 11:03 and I want to die.
Yeah, Matt, do you understand any of those words that you just said?
InBev, that's the only one I understand or will recognize. Meatball Ron explained to Fox News, we had over $50 million worth of InBev stock in the state pension fund, and the dip in value, which, this is me now interjecting, which came after conservative influencers like Ron DeSantis encouraged a consumer boycott, impacted, quote, back to Ron DeSantis, hardworking people, like police officers, firefighters, and teachers. Further tweeted the Florida Gov, all options are on the table, and woke corporations that put ideology ahead of returns should be on notice. Catherine, before we go any further, can you explain, like very slow, why it's a bad idea for an elected official to threaten legal action against the totally legal marketing decisions of big-ass consumer companies and using public sector pension funds as the excuse?
Yeah, it's a bad idea for that to happen for a bunch of reasons. One, because we have free speech and freedom of association in this country, and so we don't like it when our politicians tell people or corporations, because corporations are people, as you know, that they can't say or do things that are not illegal. That's like a really straightforward, easy rule. Is it illegal? Great. Then it's Ron DeSantis's business. Is it not illegal? It is not Ron DeSantis's business. And it is very much not illegal to make custom beer cans for a random influencer. Although, should it be? No, it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. I'm going to resist the temptation.
Nick, when DeSantis back in May signed a state law against the Environmental, Social, and Corporate Governance Movement, or ESG, as you well know, his office sent out a fantastic press release with a lot of quotes, and I'd like to read you one and get your reaction from the state chief financial officer, Jimmy Patronus. Which
is
funny.
Wait, is that what Harry Potter says before he turns you into a unicorn or something?
Yeah.
Woke Wall Street wants to cozy up to the CCP and Dylan Mulvaney! Exclamation point. Left-wing media can hate Florida all they want, but under Governor DeSantis's leadership, people are leaving blue states in droves! Exclamation point. Our stance against ESG is another signal to the rest of the world that Florida believes in prosperity. We believe in freedom. And we're a place where, all caps now, woke goes to die! Exclamation point. Nick, my question is it possible to push back against stuff like ESG without becoming Jimmy Patronus? Or is becoming Jimmy Patronus, besides my next coming of age novel, the essential precondition for pushing back against stuff like ESG?
The circle jerk scene in that, Matt, is just going to get banned in every middle school, preschool library.
He means the punk band.
I'm excited for young, like de-aged Leonardo DiCaprio to play you.
Yeah, I guess the circle jerks aren't in many libraries, Matt, right?
It's because we don't live in a free country.
To put it bluntly. Yeah. The main takeaway of all of this in a particular way is that Florida is benefiting from its relatively low tax, low regulation, esprit. And they are challenging people, like, at what point? I mean, this is, they are adding, you know, one more obstacle to see when people are finally like, okay, I don't want to go there. But I think it's absolutely important to keep in mind that Florida and Texas, which is, you know, does similar things, they are the magnets. They are where Americans are moving and where increasingly immigrants are going to, too, despite open hostility from the state legislature. So I want to do two things. One, I want to make the libertarian case that laws and governments don't matter that much. That, you know, when you have people moving to places where they disagree with the government, that kind of means that the government doesn't matter very much. And I think that's a great thing. But to go back to what I think Catherine was getting at, the biggest problem is concentration of power in the hands of the few. That can occasionally happen openly in market ways. When you gain market domination on something, the way you maintain that is by giving more people more shit for less money with less restrictions on it. That's what Standard Oil did. It's what McDonald's did. It's what AOL did, you know, in marketplaces that weren't completely rigged. With governments, we need to move quickly and fully towards the type of pension, public pension reforms that the Reason Foundation is pushing forever, where it puts investment decisions in the hands of the individuals who have fucking earned that money, and they get to roll, you know, the dice on whatever stocks they want. So I think for me, this is the most important thing to be taking away from all of this. One is that governments ultimately don't control, you know, whether a state is good or bad. They can add to it one way or the other, but they're not as important as people think. But even more importantly, from a policy point of view, we need to get to a defined contribution that is ultimately made by the individual earning the money and taken out of the hands of bureaucrats.
Peter, you're from Florida, but you also have a special place in your heart for Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is right up there in Joe Lancaster's headline.
And Bud Light. Let's not forget, Peter is an evangelist for Bud Light.
He is, right? That is true.
That's what his Substack is about.
How is Bud Light, how does it resemble making love in a canoe? I'm just going to leave that, let that dangle. You can just fill in the blanks for yourself. Peter, more pursuant to this
podcast.
That is
like a silent generation joke, Matt.
It's so good. Can you, Peter Suderman, sketch out the left flank of the horseshoe theory of government or government Budinskyism here and how we see it on a daily basis right there where you live in Joe Biden's Washington?
To answer your first question about making love in a canoe, I think the problem is that you're rocking the boat either way.
Please don't.
No.
And you don't want to rock the boat.
Nope. Sorry. No. Nope.
Instead, you want to rock the vote.
Yeah,
that's right, Catherine.
Oh, my.
I hate you all.
The left flank of the horseshoe theory, which I think is my favorite part of a cow to slow cook during the summer. All right. So let me see if I can answer this question without. Nope. Can't do it. I think that the thing that you are looking for is that Elizabeth Warren and Ron DeSantis are doing the same thing. Like, fundamentally, what they're doing is they're saying a corporation said some stuff that I don't like, and therefore it is my job as an elected official to do something about that. It's not. It's just never, ever an elected official's job to do something about somebody else saying something. Like, people saying stuff, that's what you get to do if you're a person. And if you're a person who works for a corporation, if you are a representative of a corporation, you still get to say stuff. That's how free speech works. And Ron DeSantis doesn't understand it. And Elizabeth Warren doesn't understand it. I do want to just say, though, like, thinking about the ESG funds, I found myself thinking about the movie Heathers. Right. So you guys remember this, like, kind of dark comedy with Christian Slater from the late 1980s?
Winona Ryder, please.
And Winona Ryder, right? And they're like the rebels in school. In the end, Christian Slater has this plan to blow up the school. And he has this great quote that's sort of ironic in context, but he's like, people will look at the ashes of this school and say, now there's a school that self-destructed, not because society didn't care, but because the school was society. And I think actually, if you just replaced pension fund with school, right? Like, people are going to look at the ashes of these state pension funds. And when they destruct, they're going to be like, that didn't happen because society didn't care, but because the pension fund was society.
Can you do that in a Jack Nicholson imitation?
Yeah.
Like Christian Slater? You know, again, with Ron DeSantis, and it's fascinating to see, he, you know, massively, massively won in a, you know, in a complete rout for a second term of governor after barely squeaking into office. And that's testament to how he handled COVID. And he, you know, did not screw up. And he, you know, he helped Florida keep growing like it's been growing for a long time under a lot of different governors. That's all to his credit. But it's great to notice that his culture war stuff is not playing on the national stage, even among Republicans, because whatever else you can say about Donald Trump is not a culture warrior in the way that Ron DeSantis is. And this kind of big government conservatism that he is pushing is failing. So that's great coming out of this. And the other thing is, like, this is a place, if we're talking about horseshoe theory, you know, libertarians are in the center and we have the answers to this. The answer to this kind of antic is to individualize retirement accounts and let people actually be responsible for the money they earned. When it comes to school books and things like that, and Matt, your weird YA erotic memoirs that you constantly are threatening to publish, it's to increase school choice so that individual, you know, parents and students and schools are lining up together. These are elegant solutions. They're extremely libertarian, and they have been tried in pilot, you know, in pilot programs, and they've been successful. Let's move in that direction, especially as the, you know, not even the worst elements of the right and the left, but the modal elements of the right and the left become more and more kind of draconian, Budinskyist, and just fucking annoying.
Catherine, let's just skip over Nick's idea that Donald Trump is not a culture warrior for the moment.
Not in the way, you know what, he's being attacked by Ron DeSantis for being the most pro-trans and pro-gay rights,
pro-Bud Light,
you know, president in history. Yeah, you know,
soft,
so it's
on,
like,
Bud Light.
Yeah. Who lost Bud Light, Matt Welch?
After all, it was you and me. Catherine, Nick's reffed it a couple of times, but the Reason Foundation, which publishes this podcast, is that the word, right word? Makes it possible. On the public policy side, they've been doing this pension integrity project for a long time, where they do, like, actually concrete things to diffuse the ticking time bomb of the horseshoe theory. Can you, is there something specific about what they do that can help diffuse the culture war aspect of pension management, to your knowledge?
I mean, they are providing a really valuable service, right? They are basically pro bono consultants to public officials who have realized that they're absolutely fucked. And that is a gift, right? So the idea is, like, what do we do? How can we help these folks redesign their pension plans in order to keep them solvent? That is a different project than the one that Nick was just describing of, like, maybe it would be better if everyone was just in charge of their own retirement. But it is related, because you end up in the situation where, of course, taxpayers are on the hook when the pensions can't pay their bills, the pension plans can't pay their bills. And also, in general, you just want people to not be looking at pension plans and not thinking about them. You want them to work, and you want them to be apolitical, and you want them to pay what they promised to pay, and you want to move them toward individual control and defined contribution rather than defined benefit. All of that is awesome work. I often think of this pension stuff, when the pension returns show up in the conversation, I often think of the way that the immigration debate unfolds in libertarian circles. Two wrongs don't make a right, is my take on this, right? So there are public pension plans. They are politicized. They are invested in companies that are being politicized. The fact that some people's retirements are on the line and in the hands of Ron DeSantis and his cronies still does not justify making more bad policy or doing more bad governance just because those exist. Likewise, sometimes people say, oh, we should restrict immigration because we have an overly generous entitlement program or, like, an overly generous series of benefits that are available to immigrants. Again, two wrongs don't make a right. Just because we have screwed up on the entitlement side does not mean that we should restrict immigration. Same deal.
If we're both sidesing this, which is a nonsense verb, but if we're, like, actually trying to kind of weigh the amount of horseshoe Budinskyism that emanates from Democrats and from Republicans, Peter Suderman, I'm guessing that the Democratic monkeying around with pension funds as a tool for social policy, a backdoor into social policy, would pretty much massively outweigh the Republican side, right? Like, I live in New York City. We have a comptroller here named Brad Lander, who is a human clown show And every single week, it's like, I just sent BlackRock a testy email telling them not to appoint their board of directors some guy who likes fossil fuels. It's like, what are you, why must you breathe? This happens a lot. And one shorthand way of thinking about this is just the name Lina Khan. How much more press outrage is going to be directed at Ron DeSantis this week for doing this clownish thing about Bud Light than is directed towards Lina Khan from mainstream news outlets, head of the FTC, who's been opposing basically any time two companies look at each other flirtatiously, has been trying to crack down. Is there a lopsided approach, do you think, comparing Democrats to Republicans traditionally when it comes to getting into the affairs of big private sector corporations?
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Lina Khan? Do you know anything about her? Do you like her?
I'm not a fan of Lina Khan. She's the head of the FTC. And yeah, look, she is a progressive technocrat in the Elizabeth Warren mold who has been put in charge of the FTC. And she made her name as a scholar with a big paper 5 or 6 years ago about Amazon and about how Amazon's size and scale made it inherently suspect as a business. It wasn't necessarily that she was arguing that Amazon was doing something that was specifically bad for consumers. Instead, what she was saying was, well, Amazon is just so big that we kind of have to treat it as something else, as a different category of thing that demands oversight and demands regulation just for existing in its size and in its scale, for doing what it does. And just last week, the FTC, along with the DOJ, published revised guidelines for mergers, which can be interpreted. They don't specifically say these words, but it's not unreasonable to interpret them as saying, welp, you can't really merge anything at all, at least if the things are very big. And so Lina Khan has been out there saying, here's what corporations can do, here's what they should do, here's what I'm going to let them do. Now, fortunately, the courts have been responding pretty strongly by saying, actually, all of these FTC and DOJ lawsuits, the vast majority of them have failed in courts. Most recently, the FTC's bid to stop Microsoft from acquiring Call of Duty maker video game company Activision was struck down in the courts just over the last couple of weeks. So the courts have actually been pretty good here. But Lina Khan is absolutely just sort of has appointed herself the czar of what corporations can and can't do, at least if they are operating at a specific, you know, at a certain size. And it's really bad. And she is being cheered on by a lot of the press. Meanwhile, yes, DeSantis is investigating Bud Light, and it's really dumb. It's really, really dumb. And we should just stop to say one more time, it's so incredibly dumb. But it's not having the same sort of practical impact that a lot of what the Democrats are doing is having. And I think in general, the ESG stuff just has a lot more practical policy impact. But because journalists, because a lot of sort of people in culture and policy making institutions look fondly on, if not the methods, then certainly a lot of the goals of the ESG movement, it just doesn't get as much scrutiny.
You know, the ESG movement, though, is also fundamentally a private sector activity. I mean, this is coming from private companies who may or may not be sussing out whether this will play well with the government, but it's bigger than a bunch of regulators, whether they're right wing or left wing. It's people who have amassed huge influence on investment decisions that are pushing agendas as well.
I will say, though, that, I mean, in defense of those who are really quite concerned about ESG, they do have some excellent points. We ran a piece in Reason Magazine last fall by Samuel Gregg that I really recommend to people who are struggling with the tension between, hey, private corporations or even whole industries can agree and do what they want, and hey, I don't think this ESG thing is great. He has a really compelling description of the ways that these type of movements go from voluntary to compulsory. And I think that that's just a really important point to always keep in mind here. It is not just that the Ron DeSantis's and Elizabeth Warren's of the world are waking up in the morning and bullying corporations, but also that corporations do get together, write rules, and then the SEC or whoever else pops up and says, those are awfully nice rules. What if we just made them into laws? And that step is the step that libertarians should be worried about. That is the step that I am worried about. It is easy for that to quietly happen. After all, we all already agreed, us corporations, that we were going to do this anyway. But it, in fact, is where the damage is done.
And in fact, the Brad Landers of the world and other comptrollers and people who sit atop of gigantic public sector pension funds have been some of the more aggressive pushers and adopters of that, and where they can write those regulations, they do. All right. Speaking of corporatism, last week, President Joseph Robinette Biden II had a closed door meeting with the head of the United Auto Workers Union, which represents about 150,000 workers for Detroit's big three automakers. UAW is, for the moment, withholding support for Biden's reelection, while Donald Trump is actively seeking it. That would be incredible if that flipped. I don't think it will. All this is in the run-up to a possible strike this September, which, if it happened, might only be the second biggest labor walkout in what might be shaping up as the biggest summer of strikes since Greg Maddux was an active pitcher. UPS, the parcel delivery service company, the Brown, I guess, might see a strike August 1st of 325,000 employees, up to, let's say, if contract negotiations with the Teamsters break down. And then, of course, we have much of Hollywood and perhaps soon even Broadway going on strike. Is it all a coincidence? What does it all mean? And Catherine, more importantly, what are libertarians to think about it?
The Hollywood strikes have a particular way always of just, I just automatically assume I'm against them. And that's just like, it's a bad thing about my character, right? Like, it's just like actors being theater people about their strike makes me mad.
You're a band geek.
It's
what
different.
Right do you have?
Yeah. Yeah. But you
well,
know,
she
that
also
is...
worked behind the scenes in the theater program, right? She
we
was
don't
a
need
black
to get
shirt,
into my personal.
And so
oh my,
she has,
my personal
she has
history
beef
here
with actors.
Maybe.
Which
anyway,
is funny because of how many actors are on staff at Reason.
It's fine. What I'm saying is that my natural predisposition against strikes and also against actors has really come together here in a temperamental opposition to this particular cluster of strikes. And also my total reliance on UPS for my household to function makes me against that strike as well. But more broadly, I think there's just this fantasy that people who want to center labor in our politics always have that, like, the workers are going to rise up any day now and then it'll all be different. Right. And so there are enough of those people in the media and in particular, the New York Times' labor coverage, which is a lot, who kind of want to like wish cast that. They want to like manifest the summer of strikes. They want to bring into existence the proletariat, you know, rising up. And in fact, in the United States in the 21st century, I think that that's really unlikely. I think there's going to be a few strikes. They're going to maybe get a few concessions, and then we're all just going to go back to our ordinary business. And that will be fine.
Nick, I think you might agree with me that my instinct is to support a Hollywood strike.
Yeah.
Because they're the type of labor union that we should be thinking about more in the future. Ad hoc collections of people working together to make health insurance, private sector, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And to set a floor, not a ceiling, on earnings. They allow
for
like
quite
baseball.
a lot of non-union work on the side, right?
Yeah, I think so. And they're also the most intelligent and morally principled people in the world. So, you know, we always go right by taking cues from celebrities, especially about things unrelated to their expertise.
Yes. Andy Kaufman pointed out correctly yes. that he was from Hollywood.
Oh, that's right.
And people are smarter there. So yeah. Get in line. No, my question to you was not about Hollywood. It's more about, like, I know you interviewed Mike Rowe recently. Oh. You've been talking to and with and about some people about stuff like labor force participation, work ethic, the men's, what's happening with all the men's. Do you think there's anything from that category of analysis that has anything to do with this, or is it just more kind of a coinkydink?
You know, Matt, I want to, you know, when we do this so rarely, I'll have to remind people that you and I wrote a book about a dozen years ago called The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. But I think what this threatened summer of strikes is showing, but especially the Writers Guild and SAG-AFTRA, is that we are at the end, the long kind of never-ending end of an era. And when you look at the way that movies are distributed, TV is written, the way people, more importantly, the way people consume culture, particularly stuff that used to be under the umbrella of, you know, studios based in mostly on the West Coast and whatnot. That system is dead. It's dead in music. It's dead in movies and TV. It's even dead in publishing. But we haven't figured out what comes next. And I think what you're seeing here are many legitimate gripes on the parts of writers and actors and other people outside of, you know, studios, which themselves have morphed tremendously. And that this is what we're witnessing, you know, the last gasp of a 20th century set of institutions, mindsets, and negotiations and settlements. It's the same thing with the United Auto Workers. You know, a big part of the UAW's complaints now is that they want to end the two-tier system, which the UAW put into place, you know, starting about 20 or 25 years ago, where in order to preserve the old people who were in that system when the auto industry had protection from foreign imports and whatnot, they had gold-plated pensions and all of that. New people got hired at much lower rates. They got shittier benefits. They got shittier retirement benefits and whatnot. And that's how they financed, you know, trying to ease out of the old model. Now they're saying, oh, we have to go back to that. I mean, we are just witnessing the end of a massive era across a lot of industries and a lot of parts of society, including politics. I mean, the reason why Republicans and Democrats can't maintain majorities is because the coalitions they were designed to represent don't exist anymore. So they, you know, they eke out a win for a little bit and then it goes back to the other thing. So I think in that sense, I'm very sympathetic to the actors and the writers and a lot of the other people who make Hollywood stuff, because the, you know, most of the studios are either bankrupt or about to go bankrupt. Some of them have massive amounts of cash. And when you're talking about something like Netflix or Amazon, but they don't know what they're doing. They don't have a coherent business model going forward. And so you see all of this across the board.
Peter, build on that a little bit, since you focus and specialize a lot on Hollywood and content creation and whatever things. Can you walk us through sort of like the emerging technology fear and streaming residuals a little bit for us normies who don't quite understand it, or to the extent that you understand it yourself?
Yeah. So if you go back in time to the heyday of Hollywood, which in many ways was the mid to late 90s and then through the aughts, Hollywood had a ton of different revenue streams. So every time, and I'm just going to talk about feature films, but this actually goes for a bunch of other projects as well. Every time they made a movie, they would start by releasing it in theaters and it would make hundreds of millions of dollars if it was a hit. But then even if it wasn't necessarily a huge hit there would be a DVD market. And the DVD market would sell a bunch of copies and they would make a lot of money off of that. And then it would also, you know, there would be a rental market for the DVDs as well. And it would go to cable, pay cable first, right? Start at something like HBO or Showtime. And then eventually it would end up on, you know, sort of pay ad-supported cable, maybe TNT or Comedy Central. And eventually, some number of years later, it would end up on NBC or ABC or one of these, one of the big broadcast networks. But each time that happened, there was a big amount of money involved. And that meant that everybody involved in the project got paid. Then something happened in the late aughts that changed everything, which was Netflix came around. And in particular, Netflix started building original series and original features. And then the studios started competing with them. And what happened there was the DVD market completely collapsed. Also, the window between theatrical release and release anywhere else just got shorter and shorter and shorter. So there was less time, right? And so because of this, people went to movie theaters less often, and you had to draw them out with ever bigger events. So studios changed their business model to be making fewer movies that were more expensive movies that were more likely to be surefire bets, which basically meant they made an awful lot of comic book movies. And folks, I saw every single one of them and talked about most of them on this podcast. But what that meant was when the comic book movies stopped working, then that's a real problem. What it also meant was there's only a couple of places to make your money, right? You can make it in at the box office, and then it goes to streaming after that. Nobody buys the DVD. Okay, yes, some people do, but it's only weirdos at this point. And it goes to streaming, and people can see it just a couple of months later, and it has meant that there are just fewer and fewer revenue streams. And that is a product of technology. That is a change in distribution technology and in what is, and you know, it's, this also come with, like, you can have a great, giant flat screen television and home theater system, you know, now for relatively small amounts of money. This is like, so seeing a movie at home has become a more preferable environment, like a better environment for a lot of people relative to, say, in 1995. And what all of this has meant is that all of the creative partners involved in making TV and involved in making movies are now fighting over a smaller number of revenue streams, one of which completely collapsed during COVID when there basically weren't movies for about a year. And going forward, the thing that is going to happen here, that even writers who are supporting the strike, folks like Zach Stentz, who wrote this in the New York Times, are saying, look, the way that this is going to work is hopefully we will have a better life, you know, more money for people who have careers and have reputations and are able to do this regularly, but there will be fewer people doing this. The fight in Hollywood right now is a fight over what is likely to be a shrinking pool of money and how many people end up being able to do this, to do creative work. And I think, you know, on the one hand, I am sympathetic in some ways to the writers who have some legitimate complaints about how they've been treated and about the changing ways that their contracts have been structured and what kinds of money they've been able to make. But I will just end this by saying that labor wins here are necessarily going to restrain creativity. And they are going to make movie production more expensive and a narrower prospect, in particular, or television production. And in particular, writers are asking for something for minimum staffing in writers' rooms. And that, I think, is a really big mistake. Because if you look at some of the most interesting projects that have come out on television in particular over the last decade or so, they've often been primarily written by one person. And I would say, very specifically, The White Lotus on HBO. Every episode basically is written by just one guy. And so if you had to have a bunch of other people who are paid to sit around and be in the writer's room, like that's a different process and that show might not exist at all. Certainly it would look different than it looks right now. And so I think that to the extent that, you know, on the one hand, you can support writers and you can support the actors here. I think even if you're a libertarian, you can say, okay, this is not entirely unreasonable. But you also have to understand that when labor makes demands, what they are making demands for is are restraints on how these things are produced and on the tools and technologies that are available.
Catherine, let's give you the final word. You are a libertarian dictator queen of the day. What do you change in terms of federal law and labor unions? Go.
Ooh. I don't actually have a great answer to that, but I do think that the National Labor Relations Board is a opaque and often unpredictable entity. It has powers that are beyond the scope of its oversight. And I'm pretty sure that that thing is a big part of the problem. So I'm going to take a long, hard look at the National Labor Relations Board and maybe just, I don't know, dynamite it.
All right, we're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a micro moment. Remember to email us your brief questions to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Brenner Roth, who writes in part, because it was long, from my vantage point, it's hard to say politicians and pundits like Trump and Biden aren't knowingly duplicitous in their own position points. Regarding Trump, I personally will not believe anymore that he legitimately thinks the election was stolen. Regarding Biden, he must have known the OSHA vaccine mandates and the student debt forgiveness proposal would be struck down, but acted oppositely. Like your language, Brenner. Are we as Americans allowing this cycle of lying to occur via the red-blue divide? I hate to say it, but do libertarians need to fight the same way? Lie until you get power. Continue to lie until overwhelming pressure not to, all to support a view of the greater good with the ends justifying the means. Apologies for the extremely cynical question, but to quote Zoolander, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. Catherine, greater good lying? Yes?
We're still against the noble lie here at Reason and hopefully generally in the libertarian movement. This sentiment is really common and is how we got where we are. This idea that the other side already broke the rules, and so we have to break the rules too to level the playing field. We will have no playing field left if we keep leveling it in this way. It's just going to be, I don't know, a open pit mine or like, I'm sorry, I Welshed. But the, you know, this is a very, very human response to what I think the letter writer correctly identifies as like a bunch of gross lies. But it is not the way forward. We need to just keep saying things we think are true and then describing the conclusions we come to from those true starting things and hope that eventually enough people can hear that and process it in a useful way.
Nick, do you recommend just go ahead and taking crazy pills?
You know, I wish they were available by mail. I would be certainly taking them on an almost daily basis, Matt Welch. I reject the premise of the letter. I don't think that Biden assumed that this stuff was illegal or would get struck down. The history of federal policy and big gambits or, you know, legal gambits is that you're never sure. So you keep testing and testing and testing. You know, when you think about the way that anti-abortion activists were motivated, you know, Roe versus Wade seemed to make a fairly stable ruling that wasn't going to be changeable in any meaningful way. They ended up winning, you know, in a profound way, not in a complete way, but in a serious way. So I kind of reject that. But beyond that, lying is not good. You know, it's no way to get or hold power or live with yourself.
Peter, you're a martini millionaire. What do you say?
I say I wish I was a martini millionaire. But that's a lie, Matt Welch, and you should not be lying just because other people are doing it.
That's hyperbole, really, for talking about it. But no, what yeah. do you what
That's
do you say
what the liars
me?
Say. No,
yeah, my lies are hyperbole and your lies are lies. Yeah. So that's
no,
how it is.
I mean, I agree with Catherine and Matt. The mendacity of others is not a justification for mendacity on your own part. You should be able to justify what you are doing on its own terms as good rather than as necessary because the other party does something bad that you don't like that you feel like gives them an advantage.
I think also it's important to draw a distinction that people just so many arguments are flow from not drawing this distinction. But there are people who are in the kind of fact seeking business or way of life or something. And those who are in the power seeking and exerting business and way of life and et cetera. And those are different areas of activity, even if people might broadly share the same kind of set of wishes for governance and ideology and whatnot. And just to recognize that it's different. And if when you start seeking and exercising power, you are going to do the things that power does, which is it can be pretty corrupting. And also, if you are in your ivory tower, Nick Gillespie, you might become a little bit abstracted and alienated from how the normies consume politics. This is a tale as old as time, as Walt Disney taught us. So you know, some people are comportmentally drawn towards always agonizing over political power. You know, back when Nick Gillespie and I wrote a book together, what did people ask us the most when we were on our never-ending John Cougar Mellencamp and Bob Seger tour of the Heartland?
I have no idea what you're about to say, Matt. I have no idea what people mostly ask us. And I was sober as a judge that whole trip, whereas you were drunk most of the time.
But bitterly so.
Yeah.
No, they asked us, like, basically, what is to be done politically? You know, how should libertarians vote? Who should we root for? What should the LP do? And all these kind of things. And to which we would generally reply, that was not the point of the book necessarily. And if there was one about political action, it was like swarm to an individual topic, get that thing done, and then move on to the next one. But it's a normal human instinct. And, you know, we could be the abnormies here, and that's fine.
We always are.
I love the idea of mainstreaming the term abnormies.
I'm just like throwing stuff against the wall with the
language. Horseshoe Budinskyism is my favorite phrase now, Matt.
You'll forget it after you take the next crazy pill. All right.
Forget what?
Speaking of crazy pills, last week, Democratic presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Testified in a contentious hearing of the House Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government.
Which is real.
House Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. About his experiences being on the Budinsky end of federal government jawboning of social media companies to throttle individual users over alleged misinformation. In this case, RFK Jr., and I didn't know this at the time, basically found out about it Friday by reading Matt Taibbi at Racket News. He apparently in 2021 responded to the death of baseball legend Hank Aaron. This was RFK Jr.'s response, that it was, quote, part of a wave of suspicious deaths of elderly closely following administration of COVID vaccines. That's how we mark our dead legends. But even more ridiculously and much more worryingly, Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii, who I could totally pick out in a police lineup, emailed Twitter requesting Brian Schatz emailed Twitter requesting that the tweet be taken down. He was a senator. He was like, hey, Twitter, can you take down RFK Jr.'s tweet about Hank Aaron dying? Twitter refused.
Not even a Braves fan, Matt.
Well, we don't know that. It was America's team. Maybe he was just sitting there mainlining TBS.
I'm assuming if you're a Hawaii senator, you're following the Japanese league, Matt.
Wow. Racial profiling. Instagram did, however, nuke Kennedy's account a few weeks later, even though Twitter keeps the tweet up to this day. Anyways, the hearing predictably was a hot mess. The hearing of the House Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government got a little bit politicized. So let's quickly go around the table, unlike this windup, and get one takeaway each from this wonderful hearing. Nick, why don't you go first?
As a critic of RFK Jr., look at my and Zach Weissmuller's interview with him, as well as Liz Wolf's video against his ideas. What my takeaway was, there is an establishment in America which will do everything to repel people who challenge it. I have very little sympathy for RFK Jr. as a political presence, but what you saw there was a Democratic Party that is trying to destroy any possible challenge to its establishmentarian candidate.
Peter Suderman?
I just like the idea that some group came up with the Disinformation Dirty Dozen, which is a movie I want to see with like a CG Steve McQueen.
That's Telly Savalas and Lee Marvin. Jim Brown.
That Telly Savalas character is among the most disturbing in the history of American cinema. Do you have anything else to add to that, Peter, or are we moving on to Catherine Mangu Ward?
I think we should move on to Catherine, but let's really just focus on the idea that these incredibly moronic marketing campaigns actually seem to have purchase inside social media companies, because Twitter actually seems to have been like motivated to respond to the Center for Countering Digital Hate's Disinformation Dirty Dozen list. And that's the sort of thing that just should like make you go, ugh.
I really wish it was the same songs that were on the PMRC's Dirty Dozen list. Yeah. Like it just.
Darling Nikki, FTW. Yeah. Catherine?
Yeah, I guess I'll just flag that before the hearing got going, after Kennedy's opening statement, everybody's favorite Congress gal, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, tried to move the whole thing into executive session, basically just because RFK, like, he said bad stuff in a totally separate context, not pertaining to this topic at all, which failed. The motion failed. So props to everyone for keeping it together. But the very notion that, like, we have to move congressional hearings into executive session because someone might say something mean is a bit wild. That is a theory that I fear will take hold as time goes on. And I do want to give NBC credit for the most hilarious subhead on the coverage of this hearing, which just was, quote, I am being censored here, comma, Kennedy, comma, a Democratic presidential candidate, comma, told lawmakers at the nationally televised congressional hearing. Yeah.
That's a bag of Richards right there.
I appreciate it. Yeah. The structure and oomph of that subhead, even if, in fact, he was like a little bit being censored, like actually having his speech restricted by actual government agents, which is what censored means.
Brian Schatz, for that email, should resign. Screw you, Schatz. Mm. All right, let's get to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming. I presume, Peter, that you've been like that guy in the movie Brainstorm who has the virtual reality set and just looking at porn, twitching for like hour after hour with the weekend at Barbenheimer's. So why don't you lead us off?
Yeah, I saw Barbenheimer. That is Barbie and Oppenheimer. Now, sadly, unlike several of my recent colleagues, I did not see them on the same day. I did not make a double feature of it, but I did see both of them last week, like an awful lot of people did. Big, big weekend at the box office. I liked Oppenheimer much better of the two, but I think Nick's going to talk about that. So I will just say there were many things I liked about Barbie. It is formally daring, and there's actually like a real creative vision. It's a bizarre and kind of absurdist take on a toy world. But it also has some serious structural problems, I think, particularly in the second act, the first part of which sets up a fundamentally different final conflict than the one it actually delivers. Now, the final conflict that we get, it does contain an interesting idea, and I won't spoil it, but it's a funny and clever idea about like who ultimately is Barbie's real enemy in the world. What would that look like? And the movie has, I think, a pretty good answer to that question. But then it treats its conflict as a fundamentally political conflict, and it treats Barbie as a fundamentally political statement. And I think that is its big mistake, is that it's not that there's no politics associated with Barbie. It's not that, you know, any sort of... it's not that it's totally inappropriate to bring politics into that world. It is, however, I think somewhat of a misread and just a mistake in terms of entertainment and in terms of thinking about like, what are we going to do with this weird toy world to treat it as like, oh, you know what? Mostly this is about, you know, about men versus women. And in the end, the women just all need to get together to get out the vote, because that is, in fact, what the third act is about. So Catherine is really going to enjoy the movie when she sees it, is what I'm saying.
Nick, I feel like you Oppenheimering.
Yes, I was very excited to see Oppenheimer. I'm a big Christopher Nolan fan. And, you know, I think Dunkirk, among others, is like a fantastic war movie. But I was deeply disappointed in Oppenheimer. I think it's a good movie. It is an almost complete moral evasion of the issues raised by dropping two atomic bombs on Japan. And it ultimately reduced, you know, the incineration of a couple hundred thousand people to a bureaucratic argument, procedural over Oppenheimer's security clearance in the Cold War, which is an interesting story and all of that. But America, I was watching this, and, you know, when we won World War II, we forced on Germany for sure, and also to a certain degree on Japan, endless reruns of the damages that they had done to whole populations. And Imperial Japan is arguably was more brutal than Nazi Germany in the way that it treated its subjugated people, as well as its military opponents and stuff like that. But we see none of what the A-bombs actually did. And to me, at this point, you know, we need as a society to really kind of think through this. There are arguments for dropping the atomic bombs, or at least one of them. There are very good arguments against it. I am not exactly sure where I stand, but I was very disappointed that this movie really did not go into that. And the images of atomic incineration are fleeting, and they are not actually from either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. So I walked out of this deeply disappointed, and I feel, you know, even though Christopher Nolan is not responsible for this or anything, that we are in a profound way an unserious nation that is not willing to deal with our past and kind of not lash ourselves on the back over and over again for, you know, crimes real and imagined, but to actually process them and come up with better ways of thinking about things like foreign policy, international relations, and the intersection of technology and war.
So I liked Oppenheimer a little bit better than you, and I will just say that I think, you know, one argument you could make about the decision not to show Nagasaki and Hiroshima is that the movie comes from Oppenheimer's perspective, and it's how he saw the world, and he himself did not witness those things, and also had sort of a mixed feelings about dropping the bomb in one way, like he was sort of in favor of it when it happened. He became more uncomfortable with it later on. And the movie is trying to portray this, to put viewers in the position of seeing it as Oppenheimer saw it. It also like plays out those debates about like whether or not dropping the bomb saved lives by ending the war earlier, or whether it maybe was a completely horrific act that that is not in any way justified, doesn't take a stand there. And then it leaves us with this image of nuclear destruction that is very clearly a warning about the world that the atomic bomb created, and the fact that we now have weapons that could basically destroy every human life on Earth.
You know, I'm not disputing any of that. That's a bad choice, particularly by a master filmmaker who typically his work and look at, you know, something like the Batman trilogy is about the necessary need for violence in order to maintain civilization. I think it's just it's a massive blink. And, you know, you can say, you know, we have thousands and thousands of feet of footage of the nuclear effects or the after effects of the A-bomb. We do not see those very much in the same way that we don't look at the footage of the way that white people push back against black and white civil rights protesters in the 60s. We force that on other countries all of the time. If you lived in Germany in the post-war era, if you lived in Japan, we commandeered the airwaves to rub this in people's faces. I think America is a great country, and partly because we do actually grapple with this, but we often fall short of really getting across the finish line and going through this and building a consensus that allows us to move forward more positively into the future.
I'm at least heartened that the whole closing credit sequence, they played the entirety of the Sting song, Russians. That's really the only way to deal with this artistically. Catherine, what did you consume?
I read a 2017 novel, To Like the Lightning by Ada Palmer. It is the moon is a harsh mistress Heinlein with some Neal Stephenson snow crashery in the polycentric legal order mode, plus also ancillary justices gender politics. But it is not as good as any of those books. So I want to be clear, like, I enjoyed this book. It basically asks the question, what if I wrote a book in a weirdly artful, archaic style that just asked the question, can we abolish gender and also religion? An investigation. And it's a whodunit that's also a court intrigue. This book has way too much going on, but it was pretty good. And I don't know, there's like two or three more books in this series. It's possible that some of the many, many, many unanswered questions in this book do get answered. But even if they don't, you know, if any of that cluster of proper nouns sounded good to you, you might want to make To Like the Lightning your August beach read.
So last year on this podcast, I proselytized for going to, as I did for the first time last year, the Baseball Hall of Fame induction ceremony in Cooperstown, New York. It's a wonderful Americana event. Sit on the lawn, have fun. This year I went for longer, and so can recommend a piece of this which might even be more ridiculous and fun, which is the night before or that late afternoon before they have a quote-unquote parade through Cooperstown, which is literally a village. A parade of all the visiting Hall of Fame inductees who are there for the ceremony, where they just come in on the back of a pickup truck, each of them with their wives, usually, if that's relevant, driven by the Clark Foundation, which runs the entire town, as I was made to learn. And they wave to crowds that are like two or three people deep on each side. And of course, in the case of Wade Boggs, Nick Gillespie, obviously with the dyed goatee, the hair plugs, and holding the beer.
The back do of the people throw chicken breasts at him, his fans?
I was with Bill Schultz, so chicken was shouted at Wade Boggs, and when a lot of thumbs ups were done. It is probably the most ridiculous parade I've seen. I haven't been to the Halloween parade in New York. Definitely been to the Rose parade in Pasadena, California. But boy, was this goofy and really, really fun. If you like not just baseball, but also like old men holding on to their 1970s haircuts and facial hair styles. So Raleigh Fingers and Goose Gossage, Nick, are keeping it real.
Very nice.
As is Ted Simmons. Just the commitment to the bit is 100% total.
They had like 45 Hall of Famers there, right? I mean, it was some large number of people.
I think like 50. And even then, it was a little bit less than I think last year. The ceremony itself was about 20% the crowd size of last year, because there was six people inducted last year, just two this year. And of the six last year, David Ortiz, Big Poppy, very popular feller, was one of them. And so it was just filled with really happy Dominicans. So it was a lot less, but really, really fun. Cooperstown's great. And I learned, Nick Gillespie, a bit of history, which I did not know before. Just crazy. There's a lake up there. Nice, beautiful lake. And it's the headwaters of the Susquehanna River, one of America's most important rivers on the East Coast. And at some point, like around 1789 or 1790, after doing just a horrifying, like, raping and pillaging of various Indian tribes who we were mad at because they sided with the Brits, there was all this sort of collected booty and materiel on boats and what to do with them. So what they did is they built a dam to raise the water level of the lake, amassed all the boats, and then blew up the dam and then rode the tidal wave down the river so that they could transport all the material. It's true facts, people. So that's a very exciting bit of Susquehanna River history that I didn't know until this time. But that's all the history lessons we have time for, unless, Nick, you have any cross-examination you would like to give me about the crime dog or anybody else involved.
Yeah. I mean, why were there only two Hall of Fame inductees?
Because the Baseball Writers Association of America, they vote on the first round of people, right, and you have to have 75%. And they've been crowded ballots, and a lot of the ballots have been kind of mucked up because there have been players from the performance-enhancing drugs era, players who absolutely deserve to go in, like Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, they're now off the ballot, but Alex Rodriguez is still on the ballot. Gary Sheffield always had sort of whispers about him. He's still on the ballot. And so as that is working itself out and all these other people who are pretty kind of good, the vote gets divided. And so they only had the one voted in, Scott Rolen, this time. Right. And then the Hall of Fame will have these irregularly assembled veterans committees,
yeah,
who will decide on various eras. And they're the ones who installed Fred McGriff this time around.
But why aren't they installing more people? I mean, it just seems
it's baseball has always been more restrictive than other sports. Arguably, mm-hmm, that has allowed for the kind of veneer of the Hall of Fame to mean more than the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. Who knows whether that's true, but that's just then there's an overcorrection and you get other people in, like Harold Baines, who clearly doesn't belong. But it goes in waves and cycles.
In order, because Catherine is actually asphyxiating, I have a couple more questions, Matt, but just answer this one. Was there any chatter about letting in the game's greatest hustler, in all senses of the word, Mr. Pete Rose?
We saw Pete Rose.
Was he gambling?
He was signing autographs for money, and he was very small. He's no longer the big, thick Charlie Hustle of yore. No, he was sort of in a little memorabilia shop, and in kind of pathetic form.
Still got the same haircut.
Same haircut, and as another Schultz brother, who shall remain nameless, pointed out, this is Pete Rose's Super Bowl. Like, he shows up right next to it. He's banned, Catherine, because he gambled on baseball, which you're not allowed to do. So he has a lifetime ban from the Hall of Fame.
That also, speaking of Pete Rose, reminds me, of course, of A. Bartlett Giamatti, the father of Paul Giamatti. And Bart Giamatti is the reason Rose is really out of the Hall, along with Faye Vincent. But Paul Giamatti has a movie that I saw promoed at during Oppenheimer that looks like it may be the worst movie ever made, where he plays an aging or a single teacher at a prep school in the early 70s or late 60s, where he and a student that he doesn't get along with have to live in the dorms during Christmas break. So, Matt, I'll leave you with that.
I'm more dead even than Catherine is right now.
Not possible.
Thank you for listening through all of that. And we will see you next week. If you like what we do and want to hear more, go to reason.com/podcasts, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. You have like 75 interviews from Freedom Fest coming down the pike there, Nick.
Yeah, this week it's going to be with Mr. Matt Taibbi, talking about all sorts of stuff. We even talked a little bit about baseball, to be quite honest.
Yay.
That's the enthusiasm I was looking for. Also go to reason.com/donate if you want to give us money. It helps us do our operations. Okay, we'll see you next week. Goodbye.